Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a podcast about design operating at many levels, zooming out from thoughtful detail through to organizational transformation and onto changes in society and the world. My name is Andy Plain. I'm a service design and innovation consultant, coach, trainer, and writer. My guest today is speaker, author, and creativity evangelist Denise Jacobs. Denise has spoken in 23 countries around the world, is a TEDx speaker, a LinkedIn learning course creator, and the author of Banish Your Inner Critic, the premier handbook on silencing fears to unleash creativity. She's founder and CEO of The Creative Dose and is currently working on her next book to help leaders and high achievers overcome imposter syndrome. Denise, welcome to Power of 10.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. Now, I know you as a, you know, we've met a few conferences, and I know you as a sort of bundle of energy, someone who's very kind of energetic and confident on stage. And I also know you, there's a kind of quiet and reflective side of you that I've experienced also kind of off stage. So who is Denise Jacobs?
The answer is yes. The answer is that I'm all of those things, you know, and it's actually really funny because I was thinking about it earlier today and I was like, I'm like a cool, awkward, geeky, hip person. And I think, you know, like everybody, you know, we all kind of contain multitudes, as the essay goes. And, and I can be this very energetic, you know, positive, upbeat, encouraging person. And then I also have moments where I don't want to talk to anybody and I just want to read a book and have a cup of tea and a blanket on my sofa or in my bed. And I just want to hide away from the world. And I don't think that those things necessarily, you know, that they contradict each other. In some ways, I think the reason that I can be this energetic, you know, outward facing person is because I know that I need to take that time and the need to have the downtime and the quiet time and whatnot.
So how long did it take you to work out that's who you were?
You know, I think the funny thing is, I think I always knew that, but I think I struggled, and I think also too, like having a more public persona or, you know, more of a public professional front than I did, you know, when I was a project manager and stuff like that, I didn't feel like I needed to explain the fact that, like, I need to go and, you know, be by myself and read a book. But now that I'm a public speaker and, you know, keynote conferences and, you know, run workshops and trainings and stuff like that, it's very interesting to find myself. And it's still one of those things where it's like almost every time it happens, I'm surprised, you know, it's like, oh, right, I actually need this downtime. Like there's part of me that wants to be around everybody and be social and stuff like that. But I definitely have got, I think, probably within the last 5 years, maybe last 6 years or so, have really come to terms with the fact that it's like, this is an energy expenditure for me. And that afterwards, I need to do things to replenish my energy. Like when I hear about people being extroverts and how they just want to like hang out perpetually, I'm just like, wow, really? I definitely will be at a conference and I'll be like so excited to be around people. And then I'll just get to a point where it's just like, and scene, I got to go.
I think particularly with workshops, right? Being on stage is, there's a sort of the adrenaline of the gig, but a workshop is over a kind of longer term. And I think you kind of have to be the energy that carries everyone else's energy through. And I remember doing 3 2-day ones in 2 different countries, back to back. And at the end of that week, I was just like, you know, I've just a husk on the sofa, you know?
Right. I mean, it's like, cause it's a lot. And then the other thing is too, is that, and this is one of the things I love about doing like what we do is that it touches people on such a deep level that they're like, they want to connect. Like they feel close, like people feel close to you, or they feel they feel like you've got something that, that will help them, or that will, you know, like almost like, I mean, maybe it sounds funny, but almost like healing, you know, and that there's something, but, you know, just like people who are healers and, you know, laying on of hands and things like that. I mean, it's like, it takes, unless you really learn how to channel the energy, it takes energy from you. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so, yeah, that's a whole thing.
I mean, I think particularly if you're talking about the kind of stuff you're talking about, I mean, it's probably like, you know, how comedians complain that everyone just expects them to be funny
all
the
time,
right? And actually a lot of comedians, are quite, you know, down people outside of it. But it would be somehow comforting to, I don't know, walk into the bathroom and Tony Robbins was there kind of crying, just to know.
Or having like just a down moment. I'm just tired of people. Like, I just want to like, can we just like sit in the corner and just the two of us talk?
Yeah.
Like I can handle like the two of us talking. I just can't handle a large crowd like tens of thousands of people.
Yeah. So I asked you how long did it take you to work out who, you know, that's who you were. The proper question is probably how long did it take to accept that that's who you were.
And that's the thing, right? That's the thing. And I think that's the, and honestly, you know, between me, you and everybody else who may be listening to this, it's still something I struggle with. Like I was talking to, a friend of mine who's a coach, and I was like, you know, I am ambitious and I am driven and I'm also exhausted, right? Yeah. Like with the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter movement and the current political climate in the US, like I'm exhausted, like emotionally drained. And I said, but there's all this stuff that I want to do and that I want to accomplish. And he was like, you know, you need to, he was like, what I support you doing, what I think is important to do is to figure out how you work, not to work the way you think you're supposed to, not to try to work a 9-hour day. And he was like, we work for ourselves. We can do whatever we want. Like we can structure our days to work the way. And I have another friend, my friend, Claire Kumar, consults on this, like really looking at what is it that I need to be the best and most productive that I can do and do my best work. And that might mean I don't work until, like, I do all my exercise in the morning and I don't actually work until 11. It may mean I work from 11 until 3 or 4 and that's it for the day. I work 4 hours and that's it. And it's, I think, like, I personally really struggle with this, the idea of productivity, being productive, and what that means and what that looks like. What it looks like, even more so, like, what other people would be like, you did what? You're taking Fridays off? Like, what kind of madness is that? Or, you know, because there is this hustle culture, this super toxic hustle culture. And I think it's really, I'll speak for myself. For me, I'm really trying to reconcile, like, what it means for me to work. Like, what, first of all, what that is that I take a nap every day when I feel tired? Is it, you know, like, what, how does that break down? Do I not work on Wednesdays and Friday? Like, do I work a half a day? Do I, you know, do I have a day that's a deep work day and then other days that are email days? Like, just trying to figure out all of those things. But I feel like one of the gifts, quote unquote, of this time, the pandemic at the very least, is that I finally have the space to explore that. Whereas before, I never had that space.
And, you know, it's interesting you should say that because, I mean, there's so much in there. I mean, especially that kind of productivity culture, you know, it's a very tech industry thing as well, but it's also kind of everywhere, that not only should, you know, you be kind of super productive, making everything out of every hour in the day, down to the point of kind of drinking a meal that is is basically a smoothie, mm-hmm. that, you know, so you can just carry on working and not, you know, waste time eating. and then, you know, and I'm talking to someone who's growing a lot of their own food, I know, at the moment, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the taking away the joy of that, but also then not only have you got your job, but everyone has to be an entrepreneur, so you've got your side hustle going and all that kind of stuff. And I think for people like us who work independently and you work from home, everyone's doing that now, right? So you've got that. So everyone's suddenly had that experience of what happens when that all kind of blurs into their lives. There's no commute to kind of buffer and create that space, or even force some space. And I think that it's allowed people to kind of reevaluate a lot of things. Mm. But space is, two things. One is, you know, you talk very early on in your book about self-compassion, mm-hmm. right? As a really important aspect, which we'll probably come back to. But before I think you even get to self-compassion, I don't know about you with your coaching, but I find one of the first things I have to do is fight people's kind of, I'd say addiction actually, but it's kind of pushed on them too, to email, calendars, back-to-back meetings, all of that stuff, just create some space and help them to kind of set some boundaries, mm-hmm. before they can even remember who they are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that, and also I think one of the things, like one of my coaching clients, one of the things we've been working with is, and I think some of this is, it's somewhat related, is the operating under what you believe other people's expectations are of you, and actually figuring out whether those, what you perceive as their expectations of you, are actually real.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that part of that can definitely be related to time, right? Can definitely be correlated to time. Like, how much time it should take you to do something, how much time you're supposed to be, or you should be spending on, you know, X, Y, Z thing. You know, like, and again, also what it looks like, right? Like this concept of optics,
yeah,
the optics of being productive, the optics of working, the optics of being effective versus de facto productivity, effectiveness,
yeah,
et cetera.
So like leaving your jacket on your chair, hanging on your chair the night you leave, so that when you come in the late in the morning, it looks like you've been there early already and had just gone out for a coffee. It's the classic trick,
oh,
isn't it?
Oh my gosh. And you know, it's so funny. I have been out of corporate, out of a corporate environment for so long at this point in time that I'm like, that is actually a thing. Gosh, I'm so glad that I don't have to play those reindeer games anymore.
So what was the trigger for you writing Banish the Inner Critic? Presumably at the beginning you tell the story of kind of you going through it yourself. So
exactly. And that's what it was. I mean, it was so debilitating, paralyzing, like spending the first 2 days that I was supposed to be writing my book. And when I say writing, I actually do put air quotes around that, because when you're writing a book, you don't sit down, you just start writing. You have to do research, right? Most of the time you have to either do research, or you have to do a brain dump, or you have to capture stuff. You don't sit down and just start writing most of the time, at least my experience is that you don't. And so I wasn't even going to be doing like the heavy lifting writing part. I was just going to be doing research on like HTML and CSS. There is nothing there, like that was completely inside of my purview of skills and abilities, and yet I'm freaking out, right? And I had a lot of moments of freaking out, and you know, sometimes they were so debilitating that I couldn't work, that I couldn't focus, and I couldn't concentrate. And so then when I finished the book and I had like this amazing flow state, I was like, oh. And so what happened was I was excited about creativity, because I thought it was really about creative expression. And I was like, when you're able to create, blah, 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 blah. But then when I started doing all this research about creativity, almost everything that I did was like, you know, if you want to unleash your creativity and express yourself creatively, blah, blah, blah. You can't do that if you're feeling like it has to be perfect. You can't do that if you feel like an imposter. You can't do that. And everything that I was reading about creativity, so much of it kept pointing back to I was like, what blocks creativity? Like, how can you remove the blocks for creativity? Well, all the blocks were all of these inner critic things. Mm. And so I was like, oh. And so I was so interested in creativity, I started doing talks on creativity. And the beginning part was always this, before you get to this great ideation and, you know, imagination and all this stuff, you have to remove these blocks. You have to silence your inner critic. You have to banish your inner critic. And then I wrote an article for A List Apart in 2011. And so many people had so much amazing feedback. I don't know if you're familiar with the actress Felicia Day.
Well, probably if I saw her.
Yeah, she's been in a lot of stuff. She used to do a lot of stuff with, anyway, she's great. She has quite a following, and she read the article and then like posted about it and said, there's this great article. And like, I've used these techniques myself to like get a, you know, over like writer's block and get over creative blocks and blah, blah, blah. I was like, ah! Oh my God. somebody famous read my article and said it was like legit. And so I got this great feedback from it. And I kept talking about it. And every time I talk about it, people are like, oh my God, it's like you're in my head. And I was like, well, let me just make a talk, keynote presentation, whatever, that's just on this. And people I say people lost their minds, but they were like, they were so enthusiastic. Like people come up after me afterwards and be like, oh my God, it's like you were there during my master's thesis, my MFA. It was like you were standing over my shoulder. And nice. I sat down and met this guy, another web person whose name, why am I just blanking on his name, but I can remember his face. Anyway, he said to me, you know, I read your article and I thought to myself, I don't know Denise, but it seems like she knows me really, really well. And so it just kept, and so I was actually planning to write a book about my kind of creative process, like the steps that I was going through, but I had such a strong response to the Banish Your Critic keynote and all the other things that I was like, well, I'll write this book first.
It's interesting, isn't it, when you get that personal that generalizes so well to kind of everyone. And it's always the stuff when you write much more from the heart about your personal experience. And that, you know, interestingly, with talking about some of the, you know, chapter three, so you the kind of headings of the main chapters of your book are kind of, they are phrases that have come from this activity you do at the beginning of your workshop, which is everyone writes down their biggest fear, their imposter syndrome. And then they all get screwed up and thrown in the corner. Is that how it works?
So they write down their top fear around creativity on a piece of paper, crumble it up in a ball, and then they throw, it's like a snowball fight.
Right.
And they throw it across the room. And then whatever one lands closest to you, you pick it up and you read it. And so it's totally anonymous. People are writing really what they really genuinely feel and believe and their fears. But it's like totally safe because it's totally anonymous.
You don't know where it's come from.
But it's amazing. What I always thought was amazing, or, you know, unsurprising, but still like kind of thrilling when it happens, is when people are just like, I was like, how many of you are picked up something, the thing that you picked up was basically the same thing that you wrote. Or I was like, or maybe it wasn't the exact same thing you wrote, but maybe out of the list of top three fears, this is one of them.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
So I went to that kind of chapter three thing because you were talking about, I was talking about, you know, when you write from your heart and when you really write about the things that you've experienced. This is certainly whenever I write about this, I get the biggest response to this too. But it's also, it's a scary moment, right? And the chapter three is people think my work is dumb. Mm-hmm. So what are the kind of common things I don't know if you want to go through the book or the chapters, but what are the sort of common things that keep coming? You've done lots and lots of workshops, you coach people, you've written the book. What's the number one
thing? I think one of the things and I always find that this is really fascinating when I speak at a conference like Adobe Max or, you know, conferences that are touted as creativity conferences, like a creativity conference, or this is a conference for creatives. And then I go to that, and I've spoken at Adobe Max several times now. And every time, like, that is the audience that is the most like, I'm not creative enough. My ideas aren't good
right.
enough.
So an audience full of designers, right?
Yeah, right. Full of designers and other and creative people, types. Yeah. Who are like, yeah, I'm not creative enough, or my ideas are dumb, or people are going to judge me. I get a lot of people will find out I don't know what I'm doing, especially with leaders. And it's interesting. I wish that I had kind of better tracked where each kind of snowball that I have, because I actually gather up all of this stuff, yeah. And I keep it as data, where each has come from, to kind of get an overview of what are the fears that are predominant for that group.
Do you mean in sort of batches? So, you know, got a batch that are about imposter syndrome from a lot of leaders that were in a workshop.
Out of this group of leaders, 10% were saying it's got to be perfect. Or and I can't make mistakes, 25% like they're going to find out I don't know what I'm doing, 40% said they're going to judge me, whatever it is. I wish I had had it, I had organized it that way. I actually organized it by how many people said things that sounded like it's not so-and-so enough, like I don't know enough, or I'm not skilled enough, or I'm not talented right, enough, yeah. or whatever. So I categorized it that way. It's really interesting. I feel like those are some of the things. I mean, basically everything, the chapters came from the data,
yeah.
and not vice versa, right? Like that there is a big pile of people saying, I'm afraid that people are going to laugh at me.
Yeah.
Or they're going to judge me or whatever. There's a big pile of people, a big pile of stuff where people are like, people are going to find out I don't know what I'm talking about, or they're going to think I'm a fraud, or there's a big pile of I've got to do it perfectly.
Yeah. Nothing I do is any good.
I'm not good enough.
I'm not as creative as everyone else. And
I'm not as creative as everybody else.
Like, and I'm not creative. So tell me the difference between those two, actually. Because you've got two chapters, and one is I'm not as creative as anyone else, and the other one is just I'm not creative, full stop.
So I feel like they're different. One of them I say is comparison. I call it comparison syndrome. And it's when you're comparing yourself to somebody, and it can be anything. It doesn't necessarily have to be about creative. It could be I'm not as talented as this person. I'm not as, innovative as somebody. I'm not as deep a thinker. I mean, it's whatever it is, you're not as somebody else. The other one, I'm not creative, is just like, I just don't have any creativity at all, right? It's not about whether I have a certain level or not. It's like, it doesn't exist. And I did that one because I work with so many, back in the day, I was working with so many people who were software engineers and developers and more kind of technical analytical folks. And that would be what they would say all the time. Well, I'm not creative. And I was like, oh, whoop, skirt, hold up.
Because they're not a visual artist or musician or anything.
Because they're not a visual or designer or whatever. And I was like, creativity is not about the arts.
Yeah.
Creativity is about how you go about solving problems. I was like, and as a developer, you're solving problems all the time. I was like, I can't think of any other, I mean, there's barely any other profession where somebody goes, I want a computer program that does this, 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 and this. And the person goes, okay, yeah, I can code that for you. Like, what? Like, you have to understand so many things and put so many things together and do so much creative problem solving. And then, like, if you're working with different systems and different languages and trying to, like, get things to connect. And I was like, that takes a huge amount of creativity.
Sometimes people build little kind of emotional and intellectual forts around themselves with that as well, about, you know, when I'm analytical, or I'm kind of objective, or I'm, you know, I live in the real world, whatever it is, you know, I'm more kind of hard nosed than that, than, you know, that artsy fartsy stuff, you know, and they kind of reject it out of hand. Have you found, I mean, my experience is, and I would assume that that's mostly a fear reaction that's then justified and, you know, as a kind of a little intellectual kind of world that this is the bit I'm part of. Right. What have you found with those people?
I definitely think that's right. And, you know, I actually spend less time thinking about where it comes from, and more of my focus is on showing people how they are creative, like leading them through exercises, and getting them to the point where they can start to recognize that, like, first of all, that they are creative, and second of all, that it's nothing to be, like, you know, there's nothing to be afraid of, and there's nothing wrong with it. Like, to reframe it for them, so that they can see, like, oh, this is about problem solving, and I problem solve all the time. As a matter of fact, I'm awesome at problem solving. Yeah. Like, yes, you are. So that's usually what I focus on, and kind of the roots of it and everything. For me, I feel like we could get into that. I usually don't have that much time though, right? Yeah. Like, I'm usually trying to get people to, like, a certain place by the end of the day or the end of the 2 days or whatever, with the workshops, to get them to be able to, you know, have these tools and be able to use these tools that I'm sharing with them.
I mean, what struck me reading through it and kind of listening to you speak as well is how much of that is we make our own prisons. And then I was just thinking through it some more, and it's more like, it's like we spend a large proportion of, certainly the kind of first half of our lives, building an escape room for ourselves. And then we can completely forget. It's like we have a memory wipe, and yet we're stuck in our own escape room and have no idea how to get out of it. And it was interesting for me to kind of read through, because a lot of what you're doing is basically, how do you, reframing is a really big one actually, but how do you kind of dismantle or find the kind of clues and find the riddles and solve the riddles of that to kind of get out of your own escape room?
Right.
So what have you found has been most... I mean, you go into this, there's a lot more we could go into, because you go into the neuroscience of it a lot, of why that stuff blocks us and the kind of tension between the two. The short version probably be two parts of your brain are at odds with each other when you're trying to be creative, and the other part that's trying to shut it down. But what have you found most effective? You know, I call them experiments in my coaching. You could talk about these creative doses, and the activities, some of them are quite small, some of them are a bit kind of longer term, or because of multi-part. Mm-hmm. What have you found kind of, how did you come up with those or discover those? And what have you found has been most useful? Perhaps you can give a couple of examples.
Well, some of them, not many, but some of them I created myself. Some of them I experienced as, you know, like as a workshop participant or whatever myself. And then some of them, you know, I read about and then tried them and, like, found out that they were really effective. Also, you know, got some from other people, other friends of mine who were coaches and trainers and a lot of stuff based in applied improvisation and stuff like that. So there's, you know, big network of people who use these tools, but and then some of them are, you know, actual, like, cognitive behavioral therapy type of exercises and whatnot. And I just, you know, just to kind of take a step back for a moment, one of the reasons that I I really emphasized neuroscience there were a couple of reasons for it. The first one is that knowing that my audience is, so much of my audience was and is technical people.
Yeah.
Who work in the tech industry, who like science and kind of logic and analysis. I was really very aware that the content of this book could be very easily dismissed if it was thought of as like a woo-woo, airy-fairy thing.
Right,
and
yeah.
Then now that we are talking about racial stuff so much in the world, I also was very, aware of the fact that as a Black woman, there is the potential for my content to be dismissed.
Right.
And that's just a actual real thing.
Yeah, of course.
And so for me, it was really important that I had a basis that not only that my audience could kind of see as like sound, foundationally sound, but that also that I felt good about, so that I felt like this is actually based on something. This is not like speculation. And for, you know, I wrote half of the book actually not knowing why it worked.
Yeah.
I knew it worked. I didn't know why until I like kind of discovered the connection between neuroscience, mindfulness, and self-compassion.
Yeah.
And once I discovered that, I was like, this is why it works. Not like just take my word for it, but this is like scientifically proven.
Yeah. It's all of the science and the, you know, it's the most subjective and the most, well, not the most objective, but I mean, I guess, you know, neuroscience is strives to be objective, but it's those two worlds coming together. Actually, it's nice to see, because often they're kind of pulling at each other. And yet the thing we all forget is obviously we all experience the world so subjectively. And talking of which, so you know, you talked about being a Black woman.
Mm-hmm.
I've got probably about 70-30% female coaches to male coaches. And this was the first thing we actually talked about when we first reconnected.
Right.
The inner chatter, the inner critic basically, and how much the socialized kind of role. There was a thing I saw recently, which was the stop telling girls or women they should not have a voice, be nice and not have a voice. I can't remember what the quote is now, actually, but it's you know, that thing of be quiet, mm-hmm. you know, don't speak up,
don't
rock the boat.
You shouldn't be so
don't be
angry.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be so angry. Like, why shouldn't I be angry?
So I'm really interested to know, not really to make, I guess, a massive thing of it, but it for me, it's really evident. Right? And part of it's that idea of this internal and external locus of control. You know, this idea that something's happened, like I didn't get the promotion or whatever it is. Generally, not all men, but men will kind of basically go, because the people who should be promoting me are idiots, whereas women generally internalize the, oh, because I'm not good enough. Right? Is that true? Has that been your experience too?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And that like is like the first thing. The thing that I found really interesting, and I've said this to quite a few people, is I found that for some reason or another, the people that I work with and the people who are drawn to me or who are drawn to my work, I seem to have, I don't know, I would say that it seems to me to be a disproportionate number of men and white men, I would even say specifically, who are like, I totally have imposter syndrome. I totally experience all this stuff. And like everything that you said totally spoke to me. And I'm like, oh, this is really fascinating and interesting. I mean, like in terms of like, you know, the percentage of society of, you know, people in that demographic who actually have imposter syndrome might be like actually statistically small, you know, small as a percentage.
Yeah.
And yet like the number of folks that I'm dealing with are just like, that's so my world. And yeah, like I'm not a Black woman or a woman of color or a person of color, and I'm deeply mired in this.
Yeah.
So I find but I also do think that, you know, just from, you know, culturally and everything that like, and I think we talked about this when we reconnected, that I saw this, a couple of tweets, a couple of months back, and I was just like, ooh, like, wow. Like one of them was like, maybe, imposter syndrome, you know, like when women and people of color experience imposter syndrome, it's not because they have imposter syndrome. It's because they have been systematically told that their work isn't good enough. And it's like, geez, Louise, like,
yeah, I
what?
Saw that tweet too. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, when you start to think about that, it's just like, you know, that is pretty mind blowing. And it's like, yeah. And that's, it's real.
Well, it's the difference again of, you know, is it coming from internally or is it just constantly imposed on you every day? And there's
and then it becomes internal.
Right. And then it becomes that learned helplessness as well, right? Uh-huh. Which is, you know, I can't change it. I find it fascinating that you have the majority of your coaches end up being white men as well. Because I'm fascinated why I get more women than men.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's because I had assumed it's because, generalizing that women are kind of more opened to doing that kind of inner work. I think at least it's the kind of inner work that I will kind of do with them rather than men maybe wanting something more structured, like what's the Tony Robbins kind of, 12-step mm-hmm. plan or whatever it is. But, I don't know. I wonder if there's kind of something different going on there. And I wondered if you become, as you start to become aware of your privilege, and, you know, I always say I'm walking privilege, right? I'm a middle class, middle-aged, white male, privately schooled, all of, you know, everything.
And you have a British accent.
Yeah. So I get to be the James Bond villain. And so that but with that comes a kind of, if you become aware of your privilege, then imposter syndrome can really kick in, right? Because all of a sudden, all the things that you thought you had achieved because you're so great, maybe not. Well, I wonder if that's what's kind of going on with them then coming to you.
You know, I don't know. But like I said, I personally find it fascinating. I'm just like, well, I'm, you know what? I'm here to help the people who resonate with my work.
Have you noticed a difference between leaders and other people when you've been working with them?
And leaders and like a difference between them and other people in what respect?
Yeah, I guess because you work with kind of a broad group of people, or at least in your workshops that you were saying. You know, it's not just, I mean, your current book you're working on is for leaders, but you've worked, presumably you've worked with kind of people who are not leaders as well, or kind of... there's that expression, individual contributors, which I don't really like very much. But
I like to call them producers, like yes, at the producer level.
The people who actually get stuff done. Yeah. Have you seen any sort of patterns between the kinds of things that are coming up for leaders and the kind of people who are coming up when they're in that producer role?
You know, honestly, I feel like it's so similar. It's, you know, it's definitely a lot about, you know, can I do this, or, you know, how do I become more effective? I think the leaders, and one of the reasons why I wanted to focus on that is that they are so, so much more susceptible to imposter syndrome, right? That they're so much more, prone to, second guessing themselves and wondering if they're doing a good job, wonder if they're like, you know, helping their team, you know, because helping their team members grow and develop.
They're kind of more exposed, right?
Right. Yeah. But they're more exposed and have less support, right? Because as a leader, you're not supposed to, you're supposed to know everything already. Yeah. Yeah. So, in some ways, I feel like leaders, in some ways, are almost more vulnerable to, like they, like they're question themselves even more. And I also think that's kind of a really interesting paradox, right? That the more, the higher up in kind of power and whatnot that you get, the louder your inner critic gets, the more inner critical thoughts you may have.
Yeah, and the best ones, though, are the ones who really kind of come to accept themselves with all those faults and know not they, they don't have all the answers and are comfortable with it. Otherwise, they tend to end up inflicting all of their complexes over kind of everyone else, as we are seeing going on in the world at the moment.
Yes.
Indeed. I want to come back to that question I originally asked, which I asked earlier, which was, you know, we all have our sort of tips and tricks. We all have kind of things that I lean on quite a lot. So what? Yeah, I'm going to have a couple of things that I always come back to. I'm nosy. I'd really love to know what your ones are. What have you found has been a kind of effective reframe or effective, you know, self-compassion or a sort of unlocking?
So one of the ones that I feel like is a really powerful reframe is the kind of trick that I teach people to realize that they have the choice of choosing one thought over another. And that's the holding up your hands in front of your face and focusing and then shifting your focus from one hand to another. So like, you know, I tell people to like focus really, you know, put all your focus on one hand and look at all of the lines in your hands and the shapes of your fingers and everything. And then imagine that hand is holding all the thoughts that you don't want to be thinking, all of the, I'm not good enough and I don't know enough and people are going to find out that I'm a fraud and everything. And then to actually shift your focus slowly from your first hand to your second hand and put all of your focus and your attention on this second hand and look at the lines and the shapes and everything. And then imagine that this hand is holding all of the supportive thoughts that you want to be thinking, like, I can do it, I can figure it out, if I don't know, I can ask for help, I've got support, whatever it is. And then usually, always, then I say, okay, you're totally focused on the second hand. Is your first hand still there? And people are usually like, yeah, it's still there. And I was like, do you care about it now that you've got all of your attention on your second hand? Mm. And they're like, no. And the thing is that when you really focus, like you really, really focus, it's like the hand is there, but you can almost can't even see it except for in your peripheral vision, right? And when people do that, they just like, yeah. And I'm like, yeah. So with the ability to be mindful, with mindfulness and all of this that we have, you have the same power to shift your focus from one set of thoughts to another set of thoughts. When you're deeply mired in, you know, like cyclical thinking and rumination and stuff like that, it's definitely an effort. I'm not going to say that it's the easiest thing to do, but it is definitely one of those things where you're just like, oh, but I can, like, you know, like, I mean, I've had, you know, certainly in the last, you know, couple of months had times where I was very, very distraught. And even in the midst of being very distraught, there's a part of my brain that goes, wow, you're really upset. Right. Yeah. And that part of your brain that says, oh, you're really upset or you're really going through it right now, that means that I'm not the upset part. I'm not solely the upset part, right? That there's another part of me. And if there's these two different bits, then maybe there's a third one. Then maybe there's a fourth one. Maybe there's a fifth one, right? And I feel like just having that kind of awareness can help you in moments where you think that, you know, what just be you're thinking something means that it's true. Another thing that I have discovered recently, just because you're thinking, and I tell this to people all the time, and now it's like, yeah, and I've had like experiences in my life that's like, okay, I was thinking that and I was totally believing that this thought was true, but it isn't. I'm just thinking it. but it has basically no bearing on reality unless I actually test it out and I find out, I check it out, and I find out whether or not it does. So that is a really effective tool. I've also heard feedback from people that doing the inventory, like the self inventory and what they're good at and like taking a look at that really, really helps a lot. Like the reframing, a lot of the reframing exercises help a ton. I actually had a woman reach out to me from on Instagram, and she said that she suffers from depression and anxiety, and was it manic depressive, or she was, but definitely like depression and anxiety. And she said that she got my book and she went through the whole thing with her therapist. And she was like, it made a huge difference. And I was like, really?
That's fantastic.
I did a thing. So, and you know, one of the things that I found in terms of when I've gotten feedback from people is sometimes it's really, really small stuff. That it's not like a big exercise. Sometimes it's just like a sentence or like one paragraph that people are like, I read that and it changed everything for me. And I'm like, really? That's fascinating.
But it's the same the other way around, right? This person said this one thing when I was 10 years old, or it's, you know, I got this bit of feedback and, you know, I got glowing assessment and there's this one line. And it, and I went off and cried in the toilets, you know. And it's kind of small. We do, you know, small things can suddenly just. I'm guessing, and the neuroscience of that is, you know, it's just that last little thing that creates a connection between two little patterns in your brain, and then suddenly it's like, oh. But that, you know, that's why reframing is so powerful, you know. And we are born and learn to. Catastrophize and be afraid because that keeps us alive, right? But in our lives that are in general, and I'm mindful of saying this from, again, for a position of privilege, but in general, we're safe. We're certainly safer than kind of someone who's, you know, who's our Stone Age ancestors. Then it sort of over-indexes on that fear and catastrophizing side. And it's, yeah, it is important to remember that, the worst thing that can happen is often not as bad as we, you know, feel it might be.
Exactly.
I hope, at least, that it feels like it right at the moment. I think that this part of what's going on, right, just globally, there is a, it's not just the pandemic, it's also not just what's going on in the States politically, but kind of there's a lot of stuff where it feels like, you know, everyone's just that bit more strung out, but it's like a kind of permanent background thing. It's not just, oh, there was this catastrophic disaster, you know, and then life kind of carried on. It's like this constant sort of prodding of and shredding of kind of nerve endings that I think is making people feel pretty
tired, right? It's like static in the, you know, static isn't necessarily the word that I want, but like this kind of constant low level disruptive noise, right? Like kind of the same way static is, where it's like and like just behind everything all the time, and you're just like, can you, like, there's something really annoying that is like unraveling my nerves.
It's like a fear tinnitus or something, isn't it?
It really is. My gosh. Yeah.
So we're coming up for time. You are, as we talked about, you're working on a book for leaders as well.
High achievers. Yes, but before that book happens, the kind of more pressing thing that's happening is I am developing an online course helping to cultivate career confidence. So it's going to be based a lot on the work in Banish Your Inner Critic, but like specifically directed towards career confidence. And then it will also start to draw upon some of the stuff that I'm going to be talking about in the the High Achiever book around imposter syndrome and perfectionism and failure and success. Yeah.
Okay. So well, people have to look out for that. As you know, the show is called Power of 10 after the Eames film of kind of the relative size of things in the universe and zooming in and out and the kind of how things affect each other at different scales. So the final question is always, what one small thing, either a thing that you feel is overlooked and needs to be redesigned or is overlooked and undervalued, has an outsized effect on the world?
So this is actually based on an experience that I had recently. And I think one of the things that especially now is undervalued is kindness.
Right.
And I was at, there's a store here in the U.S. called Trader Joe's, food store, got yummy things. And I was going to Trader Joe's to shop. And on my way up the path, there were several shopping carts. And there was a woman who worked there who was gathering the shopping carts, and I saw her ahead of me. And so as I was walking by, I gathered a couple of them and I pushed them up to her to just to help out, just to be kind. And she was like, "Thank you so much." And I was like, "Yes, of course. I mean, especially now we need to be kind to each other because things are going haywire." I was thinking that, and, I went into the store and I started shopping, and just a few minutes into it, I turned around and she was standing behind me, and she said, and she gave me a bunch of flowers, and she said, "Thank you so much for doing that. That was really nice."
Which is also really nice that she did that as well.
Right. But the acknowledgement of it, but you know, it's things like that where, and then that kind of made my day, you know, like that made me, and then that made me feel like I was seen and I was valued and I was appreciated by me just doing this one small kind thing. And if you imagine if that happened on a regular basis, you know, like that somebody does an act of kindness and then somebody does an act of kindness back to that, and then how that could perpetuate and scale.
Yeah.
And I think it's highly undervalued.
The small random acts of kindness and rather than random acts of sniping at each other on social media.
Listen, like, and you just think, like, don't you have something better to do with your time?
talking of social media, and talking of doing better things with your time, where can people find you online?
So my website is denisejacobs.com. On Twitter, I'm Denise Jacobs. On Instagram, I'm Denise Jacobs. On Facebook, my Facebook fan page is denisejacobs.com, all written out. And on LinkedIn, I'm Denise R. Jacobs. So please connect with me on LinkedIn. Check out my courses on LinkedIn Learning, Banish Your Inner Critic, Creative Collaboration, and Creativity for All, Hacking the Creative Brain. And
will your new course be on LinkedIn Learning too?
No, my new course, the Cultivating Career Confidence, is going to be at my new, I'm calling it an online academy. I'm going to be launching it kind of more officially at the beginning of the year, but it's at amplify-u.com.
Okay.
Cool. So amplify-u.com. /career confidence, or you should be able to actually get to the career confidence page just by going to amplifyyou.com.
But otherwise, people can find Denise Jacobs wherever Denise Jacobs is online. It's almost like you thought that through really carefully.
I know. Amazing.
Denise, thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
Thank you so much for having me. It was delightful.
As I'm sure you're aware, you've been listening to Power of 10. My name is Andy Pullane. You can find me at apullane on Twitter or pullane.com, where you can find more episodes and sign up for my newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you like the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes. It really helps others find us. And as always, get in touch if you have any comments, feedback, or suggestions for guests. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.